It is almost 7 years since the Four Mile Fire set records as being the most destructive wildfire at that time in Colorado. Since then, many other records have been set. But as we approach that anniversary, we're going to speak next with Michael Kodas, who has written a new book, Megafire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. And Michael, you start the book really with your memories of being here in 2010 and being in Chautauqua in Boulder and seeing the flames, smelling the smoke, and then subsequently, you know, covering the Four Mile Fire. I mean, take us back to that.
Well, it was the first of four fires to break the most destructive fire record in Colorado in 4 years. In 2012, that record fell twice. One fire only held the most destructive record for 2 weeks before another fire in another part of the state broke it again. In the case of the Four Mile Canyon fire, I had been very interested in very big, very hot, very fast fires that were doing huge amounts of damage. Not just in the United States, but around the world. And in the case of the Four Mile Canyon fire, I kind of started to redefine what I considered a megafire. The U.S. Forest Service defines a megafire as any fire that's larger than 100,000 acres. But a small fire that behaves differently, does things that the firefighters dealing with it haven't seen before, and consequently destroys a lot of homes or takes a lot of lives, perhaps puts a watershed or our water supplies at risk, threatens infrastructure we depend on, those can be a lot more mega than a fire way bigger than 100,000 acres that's burning in a remote wilderness where fires like that have always burned, and it's basically doing the same thing that fires preceding it have done. So I began to think more about impacts of fires as a measure of their meganess rather than just their size.
Of course, us living here in the Front Range and particularly in the foothills, our impact is the human impact because so many people live up there. And we're going to get into why that is in many ways driving some of the fire policy that we're seeing. But we're losing homes. It's not just structures, but people are losing their homes in these fires.
People are losing not just their homes. Some people are losing their lives in these fires, but lots of times they lose their livelihood. Perhaps it doesn't take their home, but it takes something that they depend on, the factory where they work or a business that they're dependent on. So it affects us in many, many different ways. And across the nation, we're seeing the same thing. We're seeing somewhere between 4 and 5 times more homes burn in wildfires now than we did in the 1970s. And aside from the loss to the people who lose their homes, which is horrible, we also are seeing an increase in the loss of life of people who are trying to prevent those homes from burning.
But I want to talk about that. Who actually is fighting these fires? And you really focus a lot on the book of the tragedy in Yarnell Hill, Arizona, where 19 out of 20 firefighters, an entire group of them basically lost their life. Remind us what happened there.
So the Granite Mountain Hotshots were a very unusual crew. They were a hotshot crew here in the United States. At the time of their deaths, they were the only of about 110 hotshot crews in the country to have ever been part of a municipal fire department. And they basically evolved as a very clever solution to a very horrible problem in Prescott, Arizona, where Prescott has been named one of the 9 or 10 most likely to be burned over cities in the United States in a wildfire. And a former fire chief of the Prescott Fire Department, which is the oldest fire department in Arizona, came out of retirement to lead a wildland crew that would deal with that problem. And they started out as just a fuels crew. They would just go out and create defensible space and thin forests around homes, and gradually graduated to what we call a Type 2 initial attack crew. And those are just kind of the grunts of wildland firefighting. It's the kind of firefighting that I did years ago. And then eventually became a hotshot crew, which are our most elite wildland firefighters. June of 2013, they were called to a fire near their town, in Yarnell, Arizona. That town, when this fire blew up, was actually getting burned over by the wildfire, and it destroyed more than 100 homes in this very small community. And nobody really knows why the Granite Mountain Hotshots went where they did. For some reason, they moved into a canyon that was choked with vegetation and very difficult to move through and extremely flammable, and got trapped by the fire in this canyon. And the only real explanation explanation for why they went there. There are no survivors, no witnesses. The only person on the crew who survived was their lookout, who had already been burned away from his post, so he couldn't see what was going on. But the only explanation is that they were trying to get to the town to help out protecting structures. And that puts a very fine point on part of our wildland fire problem here in the United States, which is we train people who fight fires in forests to protect trees, to protect, you know, landscapes that are vegetated. It is a lot easier to step back from a bunch of burning trees and say, hey, this is too dangerous, I'm just going to let this forest go. It's, you know, it's not something that's that valuable to me, that important to me, that I'd be willing to risk my life for it. And now these wildland firefighters are increasingly having to fight fires that are threatening communities and homes. It's a lot harder to step away from a burning home. These guys clearly wanted to help out and took a great risk to go and help out with that and paid a very high price for it. And that's something I've encountered in my own research. And even when I got my own red card recertified after years, which is the card that certifies you to be a wildland firefighter here in the United States, when I took the test a few years ago, after many years of not having a current red card, there were a few new things in the training. One was what to do if you encountered a meth lab in the forest while you were fighting these fires, or an illegal chemical dump. What to do if you encounter a very long driveway leading to a home while you're fighting a forest fire. Back when I first got involved in this, those weren't considerations for wildland firefighters. They were expected to work in the forest, try to herd and keep the fire from destroying trees and forests, but they really didn't think that much about what to do about a fire that might burn into a community or destroy a lot of homes, or that human infrastructure or human products, activities in the woods would be something that they'd have to deal with, that idea of the meth lab or the illegal marijuana grow that's, hidden away in the woods. And what do you do when you encounter these chemicals or firearms in the woods?
This issue of the fact that we have allowed and have encouraged more and more people to live in what's called the WUI, the Wildland Urban Interface. There are startling statistics, even here in Boulder County, about how many people actually live there and how many people are projected to move there, and the impact on that, on the firefighting. Not that they're necessarily causing the fires, but they're changing the entire dynamic of how fires are being fought because of this need now to preserve and to save the houses.
Yeah, they change the equation in multiple ways. And, I'm not saying that people shouldn't be allowed to live in the woods or live in the mountains, but we have a flood of people moving to the mountains throughout the West. And the Wildland Urban Interface complicates this equation in a number of ways. First of all, firefighters have to be concerned about public safety and human life in areas where they didn't have to think about that. Fighting fires in these areas can be extremely difficult. You're dealing with steep terrain often, but you're also dealing with difficult egress. It's hard for firefighters to get in and out on the roads there. Some of these roads aren't wide enough to carry a big fire truck. They're sometimes choked with traffic from evacuations. So firefighters end up trapped with people in the evacuation route and can't get to where they need to go to do their job or to be safe. The housing itself presents a new fuel load in the woods. So, we have suddenly have propane tanks and lawnmowers and things that can explode. And we've got houses that are, not necessarily built out of flame resistant materials that can be very dangerous. And actually, in reality, they are starting fires too. It's not that they're arsonists, but a recent study at CU Boulder showed that over about a 20-year period across the country, about 84% of wildfires were started by humans. So when we put a road into a forest, right then we've changed the fire cycle in that forest. That road is going to immediately start letting sunlight into areas of the forest that the sun didn't reach and dry things out and make them more flammable. But it's also going to allow people to move in there and recreate or to camp. So you're going to see more campfires along that road. You're going to see more firearms being shot along that road, and you're going to see a new fuel load in that along that road, which is what we bring in with us when we use that road. And then everything after that, building of houses or cabins along that road, other things that we would use that road for, all of those things are going to change the fire cycle in that forest, often for the worse.
We're speaking with Michael Kotas this morning on KGNU. His new book is Mega Fire, The Race to Extinguish a Deadly Epidemic of Flame. He'll be at the Boulder Bookstore on Thursday evening. He'll be at the Tattered Cover in Denver next week, and we'll give you more information about that. This issue of extinguishing the fires, because this has really been hotly debated by various different entities about why there's been such a push to put out every single fire. There was this issue of, or a promise to extinguish any fire by 10 a.m. the next day. Talk a little bit about that and how the Forest Service has responded to fires that historically have always been seen as part of the natural process and in fact a needed process for the replenishment and the health of forests.
Yeah, you know, I think the first thing for people that live in the woods to realize is that fire is as important to the health of most forests as rain is. We don't need it quite as often, but we need fire, we need rain. There's a process that goes on there that keeps that forest functioning the way that it does. One interesting link between the Four Mile Canyon fire here in Boulder that we started talking about is that 100 years before that, exactly a century before that, was the fire that basically defined U.S. wildland fire policy for about the next century. And this fire was called the Big Burn or the Big Blow Up. It occurred in Montana and Idaho in 1910. It destroyed the town of Wallace, Idaho, and did great damage to a lot of other towns. It was a fire that was about the size of Connecticut and put smoke right across the country. Firebrands, small debris from that fire actually fell, you know, close to Colorado and sometimes in Colorado, according to historians. So it was a really vast, very powerful wildland fire, and a lot of firefighters or a lot of people were recruited to fight this fire. It's a little generous by today's standards to call them wildland firefighters, because most of the people that would fight a fire like that were just getting rounded up anywhere you could find them. I mean, they would go into bars and offer, you know, a quarter a day to every guy who would go along and swing an axe for them. And there was a renowned guy named Ed Pulaski. He was a ranger there who was leading a fire crew, and they got trapped and were about to be overrun. And Ed Pulaski led his crew to a mine shaft and held his crew in the mine shaft at gunpoint, telling them that the first guy who tried to bolt out of the mine shaft, he'd shoot. And he saved their lives. They all passed out. The mine shaft had all of the air sucked out of it. Some of the horses that were with them died. I believe three of the firefighters died. But most of the crew survived. Ed Pulaski was horribly injured, but continued his work after the fire. And the country, which was, looking at this fire as this huge natural disaster, and particularly the Forest Service, which was only about 5 years old at the time, was hated throughout much of the West because this was a government agency that had come into our forests and tried to impose some order in vast Western forests that up to that point had been free-for-alls, and so a lot of people didn't like that. The Forest Service kind of used that as a survival mechanism for them. They were able to talk about, here's why we need a Forest Service. We need an army that can fight these vast wildfires. And in fact, the next several leaders of the Forest Service were all veterans of the Big Burn and the Big Blow Up, and eventually imposed this out by 10 a.m. policy. And part of, this whole message was that fire is an enemy. It's like an unwanted species that we have in our forests, and that we could eradicate it if we worked hard enough, rather than recognizing it as effectively a weather phenomenon. So that had a huge impact on the structure of our forests over a century. It's not necessarily true in every forest or even every ponderosa pine forest, but many ponderosa pine forests, particularly in the Southwest and New Mexico and Arizona, showed a response to this, what they call now excess suppression, because a lot of these forests naturally had fire burning through them once every 10 years, once every 20 years. Well, if you put every fire out in that forest for a century, then you're going to have 10 times or more of the fuel load in that forest that you naturally would have. A ponderosa pine forest that was kind of like some of the ones we see here around Chautauqua and other areas, where the trees are really widely spaced. You could pretty much drive a car in this forest in any direction that you wanted. The trees aren't going to stop you. Closed up. All those trees, started to sprout and got very close to one another. The forest floor got shaded, which allowed other species that normally wouldn't have lived on those exposures fires in those slopes to move in, and many of those forests became much more prone to very severe crown fires. One interesting study that looked at that in the last few years, because there's still great debate over how much of the real increase in fire that we're seeing is due to putting out too many fires, and it found that on the Front Range in Colorado, only about 16% of the ponderosa pine forests are showing an increase in wildfire severity due to excess suppression. Now, that's not necessarily good news, because that 16% that we're talking about that's showing that increase is precisely the 16% that we love to build our mountain homes in. So it's the 16% that we've developed the most.
It's not just the forests, though, because you also talk about prairie fires, and you spend some time with a family of volunteer firefighters who were really impacted by a prairie fire out in the eastern plains of Colorado. They're also being impacted by species coming in, cheatgrass being highly flammable. Mm-hmm. It's not native species to Colorado, that even the nature of these grass fires that typically were also part of the natural cycle in the eastern plains, we're seeing changing dynamics there as well.
Yeah. And again, you know, fire is not only part of these ecosystems, but important to them. In Kansas, where I'm from, ranchers, even when fire was seen as this horrible enemy, many ranchers continued to burn their fields because cattle that gets brought onto these fields after the old grass has been burned away can gain up to 20% more weight. And in fact, near where I live, ranchers from as far away as Texas and Mexico still bring cattle up to graze in the Flint Hills of Kansas because their grasses are so nutritious after those fields have been burned. Fire is very native to our grassland habitats, and our grassland habitats are dependent on fire as well. And I really wanted to work early in the book on that particular section that dealt with the firefighters that fought this grass fire. This fire was called the Heartstrong Fire out in eastern Colorado, because people don't really realize that more than half of our firefighters here in Colorado, nearly two-thirds, I believe, across the country of firefighters that end up fighting wildland fires, are volunteers. You know, it's not the guys in the fancy, or the not-so-fancy, but the green pants and the yellow shirts marching in. It's a family of farmers. You know, in this case, the family made up almost half of the volunteer fire department, who are just going out to help their neighbors. And they don't get a lot of attention, particularly out on the plains, because these grass fires are so fast that even the really huge and devastating ones are out before news cameras like the ones that I operate get out there to document it. So, you know, we see lots of photos of flaming mountains because those trees can burn for days and weeks on end, and we can cover that. But often a grass fire can be just as devastating, at least to the population that lives around a grass fire, where the behavior is changing. And we don't really hear about that as much.
How much is all of this costing? Because I know the Forest Service is now spending a huge amount of its annual budget on fire suppression, which then takes money away from long-term planning and forest remanagement. But what's the dollar amount? How much is all of this costing?
So if you look at the Forest Service budget, I mentioned at the beginning of the book that in 2015, the U.S. had 10 million acres burned for the first time since those kinds of records were kept. There were almost certainly fire seasons before we developed the West where more acreage than that burned, but of course that's before we started spending all these millions of dollars fighting fires and built roads and communities and things to kind of hold back fire. In 1995, about 16% of the Forest Service budget was spent on wildfires. In 2015, in that record year, 52% of the Forest Service budget was spent on wildfires. More often than not, in more fire seasons than not now, the U.S. government runs out of money to suppress and fight wildfires right about this time of year, and they have to go and get that money somewhere else. When I was first told about this years ago, the firefighters I was dealing with called it the annual fire theft. What the Forest Service has come to call it is fire borrowing, a little more kindly term. But basically, they've got to find that money somewhere else, and they first place they go is to programs that are actually intended to make our forests and our communities more resilient to wildfire. So prescribed burns and thinning operations and community efforts that are funded and supported by the government to make communities more resilient to wildfire, get their budgets gutted to fight the fires that we have burning today. You know, in effect, we are making the fires of the future worse to have enough money to fight the fires that are burning right now.
And in terms of the economics of fire suppression, a lot of it's being privatized, particularly if you look at the aerial fleet, which relies on, a lot of it seems to be old military, you know, retired planes, those big bombers that we're familiar with, unfortunately, in Colorado, flying overhead with the retardant. But a lot of them are privately owned. Talk a little bit about the economics of how the money is being spent and whether or not it's even effective.
So one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, half or more of the money that's spent on wildfire in this country goes to the private sector. And like any industry, they want to work as much as they can. So that right there complicates the wildland firefighting process, because you're going to ask to fight every fire that you can get on, regardless of whether that fire really needs to be fought, or perhaps might even be a fire that is going to be beneficial to a forest or a landscape and maybe make the next fire less damaging. Fire is what they call self-regulating. One wildfire makes the next wildfire in that area less severe. So you end up with people really, really pushing to fight every fire. And with aviation in particular, which is a huge part of our wildland fire effort and incredibly costly, almost all the planes are from private contractors. There's some military planes that get involved in bad fire years. And there has been a long series of just debates over how we should use aircraft in wildland fire, and sometimes scandals that I cover in the book, where our fire problem was distinctly made worse by some corruption or scandals within fire aviation. But a couple of points to make. When you see these planes, and boy, you've got a bad wildfire burning towards your house or your town, it's pretty thrilling and reassuring to see a plane swoop in and drop that red stuff. But as you note, almost none of these planes are purpose-built for fighting wildfires. My father, before he passed away, had been a pilot. He was a command pilot in World War II, and the first time he saw a video of that, he talked about how nuts guys that would do that with the planes that he knew what they were capable of were doing with them. When a fire blows up, and when we most want to see those planes bombing the fire, is when they're least effective and when flying that mission is most dangerous, because the winds that drive that fire to blow up make flying above them very dangerous, and flying close to the ground and close to those flames very dangerous. And it also blows away a lot of what we're dropping out of those planes before it hits the intended target. By way of, you know, looking at the costs of that, we've talked about the financial costs, but it's really important also to talk about the human toll with our aerial efforts on wildfires. In the 2012 season that I write a lot about, 2012 and 2013 are what I really focus on, almost half of the fatalities in wildland firefighting were in aviation accidents. Wildland firefighters' chance of dying on the job goes up tenfold the moment they step into an aircraft. So it's very costly in financial terms. It's also very costly in human terms. And according to many people who study this issue, including people who used to run these missions for the U.S. Forest Service, only about a quarter to a third of the retardant drops that you see a plane making have any real impact on the final size of that fire or the intensity of that fire. By way of example, you can look at the Waldo Canyon fire in Colorado Springs, and we had C-130s, huge military planes and others, just painting the edge of Colorado Springs with retardant for a couple of days before that fire blew up. And when it blew up, it crossed over those retardant lines like they weren't even there.
in the last few moments that we have, I mean, we have to note that we're now, it seems, in a permanent fire season, and certainly the impacts of climate change on this snowpack has led to more flammable forests year round. It's not just, I think it used to be bookended, you know, late spring to early fall, but now we're really in a 12-month cycle, and obviously that's going to have a huge financial impact as well. But what is the future of this? If we look at warming temperatures, if we look at the ongoing, what many people would say is the mismanagement of fires, and then the continuing development of the WUI, the wildland urban interface, so what are we staring at now in the coming years?
So, you know, we've got a few drivers of our wildland fire problem, and we've talked about a number of them. One's climate, and so, you know, the place where you can see that easiest is in our mountain snowpack. And so many of our mountains get a little bit less snow than they used to get, and most of them are having that snow melt off earlier in the season due to the warming temperatures. Well, the, you know, that snowy peak you see above a forest is basically a trickle reservoir to keep that forest below it moist and to have it be more resistant to wildfire. So when those forests dry out earlier in the season or the snow flies later in the season, then they are prone to burn for a much longer period of time. That's extended our fire season by almost 2 months in some areas of the U.S., that reduction in snowpack that we're getting with climate change. And then, as we talked about, you know, we have a huge population moving into the woods that are bringing new fuels there, complicating firefighting efforts, and bringing new sparks, new forms of fires igniting. You know, the only natural form of fire igniting is lightning, and so we're seeing huge shoulder seasons where we have no lightning, but we're seeing a lot of wildfires. So all of those fires have to be attributed to some type of human activity, be it a power line or a vehicle or, you know, in the rare case, arson. And then we've got the complications that are brought on by how we've managed our forests, where, you know, we've put out too many fires in some places and those forests are overgrown, and in some cases we've planted something that's brought on a really bad wildfire. All of those things are pushing at each other to increase our instance of wildland fire. And so I mentioned that in 2015, for the first time since the U.S. government kept these records, we saw more than 10 million acres burn in the United States. But Forest Service scientists around the same time put forth a paper that predicted that, you know, sometime soon, probably by mid-century, we'll be seeing 20 million acres burn in the United States. So twice that amount. To give you a sense of scale on that, that's an area nearly the size of the state of Maine burning in a bad fire year in the United States. So it's a hazard that is on a rapid increase. A lot of the things that are driving this increase are not going to change anytime soon. You know, the climate change we're looking at is already kind of baked into the system. We're certainly not going to see a huge change in laws that prevent people from building or developing into flammable forests. We're probably not going to be able to treat all, you know, the forests that are deemed to be more flammable than they were historically at any great scale. We treat a fraction of the number of forests that we need to treat every year. So we're looking at all of those drivers of this increasing, and what we probably need to do is think less about fighting these fires, although we're still going to have to do that, and more about how can we live smarter with these fires.
And of course, then the pine beetle or the other mountain beetle epidemics that we're seeing as a result of climate change too. You write about all of this in the book, and people will have an opportunity to hear Michael Codis, author of Megafire, Thursday evening at the Boulder Bookstore. He's going to be speaking there at 7:30. And on September 6th, he'll be at the Tattered Cover in Denver. And in Fort Collins on September 7th at Old Firehouse Books. And we'll put information about all of these events at our website, kgnu.org. In the meantime, Michael Codis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.